Judge Connolly, Judge Riley, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 10th, 2022. We have three cases on our oral calendar and we're here for the first case. And we're conducting this hearing by Zoom and an audio recording will be posted later on the So our first case this morning is A21-1046 in the matter of the welfare of AJS Child. And we have counsel present here, and each of you, as you may know, has 15 minutes for the principal argument, your principal argument. And at the start of your principal argument, I'd ask that you state your name and the party you represent. And then counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal in addition, if you choose to. So if counsel for appellant is ready, you can begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court, your honors, counsel. My name is Mitchell Gilman, presenting on behalf of the appellant. In welfare of DTP, this court said that if a child has no prior adjudication of delinquency, the child has not triggered the statutory enhancement that's at issue in this case. This court should now clarify that it meant what it said in DTP and hold for the appellant, vacate her adjudication of delinquency and remand this case for adjudication as a juvenile petty offender. And even if DTP had not already decided the question in this case, its disagreement with this court's position in DTP at most shows that the enhancement provision would be ambiguous, and this court would need to do some statutory construction to resolve that ambiguity. Doing that clearly leads to the appellant's position and this court's opinion in DTP under principles of in pari materia, as well as principles of fair warning in Lane. The in pari materia canon is particularly applicable, as we discussed in the briefs. We discussed how, in the context and purpose of Chapter 260B, the legislature uses the phrase found to have committed to refer to adjudications, whether that be of a petty offense or an adjudication of delinquency. Specifically, we cited the juvenile petty offense statute, where the legislature expressly clarified that a child who has been found to have committed an offense is necessarily an adjudicated child. That article is a strong evidence that in the context and purpose of Chapter 260B, the legislature refers to adjudication with the phrase found to have committed. But even more.
Counsel, may I interrupt you for a minute? So I'm trying to understand. I want to give you a different hypothetical to understand how it works. Because I'm not sure if your argument depends on the stay of adjudication part of this or what. So if we were to look at the definition under subdivision 16 of 260B.006, and our focus in this case is on 16B, or excuse me, C3, right?
Correct.
Okay, so if we look at, and let's pretend it's a hypothetical, it's a misdemeanor level offense other than fifth-degree assault. So it's something that would not be captured under paragraph. And so we'll use an example of, I think, maybe a theft or something, a low-level offense. Okay, so if a person, if a juvenile, and focusing in on three, if a juvenile committed such a low level, a misdemeanor level offense, was found to have committed that misdemeanor level offense, they were never adjudicated delinquent because it was a juvenile petty offense then, right? So even if there's a disposition for it, even if there's a disposition for that petty juvenile offense, and maybe I'm confused about but even if there's a disposition for it, they're not adjudicated delinquent, but they're found to have committed it, there's a disposition, I'm assuming there's not a stay of adjudication, an actual disposition. Okay? What happens the next time that there's an offense?
Well, I think in the case that you're describing, Your Honor, the child has been adjudicated as a petty offender rather than adjudicated delinquent of a misdemeanor.
Right.
So in the context of the enhancement provision, clause Clause 3 at issue here would not be implicated. However, I would point the court to Clause 4, which has an identical enhancement for juveniles who have previously been found to have committed two or more of certain juvenile petty offenses. And we think that's actually critical here because the juvenile petty offense statute doesn't which shows that the legislature did not contemplate using the phrase found to have committed encapsulating anything less than an adjudication. So to go back to your question.
Okay, so you would say, yeah, so that person would have to commit two juvenile petty offenses under four, and then it would be enhanced, but there would be no enhancement under the first one.
That's correct.
Okay, and so is the issue around this, I'm trying to figure out, so the stay of adjudication is important to, you're saying they have to be either adjudicated as a petty offender or adjudicated as delinquent in order for three to five. Is that the argument?
Correct. And just to go back to your question, the stay of adjudication is the critical point of issue here. If we don't dispute that if the appellant had been adjudicated delinquent of a fifth degree assault back in 2017, that she could have been properly adjudicated here. But because we know the legislature intended the enhancement to only apply to prior adjudications, the appellant was improperly adjudicated as a delinquent here. And the statutory context clearly shows that. If there were principles of fair warning and lenity resolve any of those doubts in the appellant's favor, in the context of this case, there was actually no way that the appellant could have been on notice that she would face a misdemeanor adjudication in this case. And that's because when she pled guilty to a misdemeanor and received the stay of adjudication back in 2017, this court's own case law appeared to dictate the opposite result. And in fact, there's nothing in the record about whether she was ever even advised that she might have been pleading guilty to an enhanced offense. And so this court.
Mr. Stillman, having both Judge Connelly and myself in the Citizen Court Juvenile Division for a number of years, so we're familiar with how we proceeded there. And there was a distinct difference between what happened at a Rule 8 hearing and what happened at a Rule 15 hearing. The Rule 8 hearing being the plea and the Rule 15 being the disposition. And so I have two questions for you. The first one is, when I was a plea, it doesn't say has been found to have been adjudicated of those. It says has been found to have committed. And when I did Rule 8 plea hearing, I would make a finding. I find beyond a reasonable doubt that you have committed sex sufficient for me to find that you committed that. And then I would move on to either the stay of adjudication or what's going to happen. So my first question is, it seems that you're asking us to read language into that statute, specifically subdivision 3. And then the second question I have, and I'll have this for Mr. Young as well, is it seems like this is a case that there's not clear case law on, and so maybe we should make a precedential. And if we do make a precedential, what would your syllabus be?
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the first point, or the first question, we're not asking the court to add any language to the statute, because within the meaning of Chapter 260B, the legislature has made clear that it is referring to an adjudication. If you look at the juvenile disposition statute as well as the juvenile petty offender statute, when the legislature refers to disposition after adjudication, the legislature actually didn't ever use the phrase adjudicated or adjudicated petty offender. The legislature simply said that if the child is found delinquent or if the juvenile court finds that the child committed a second or subsequent petty offense. And so it's completely consistent with how the legislature has referred to adjudications in Chapter 260B to reach the appellant's position here. And further, I would just note that the statutes that the states cited that refer to adjudications of delinquency to apply an enhancement, none of those are from the context of Chapter 260B. Those are all from the adult, those are almost all from the adult criminal context, and so they're not very probative in light of the very different language that the legislature uses in Chapter 260B. With regard to your question about whether this patient is precedential, do you think that DTP already decided this question? If you find that DTP did not decide the question, then perhaps it should be precedential. And the syllabus...
But I'll write this your way, right?
I don't have a specific comment on that, but I would say that our syllabus...
My term is West probably does, but... When you're finished, I do have one question for you, Mr. Zilman.
Okay. And our syllabus would basically say what this court's syllabus said in Welfare of DTP, which is that if a child has no prior delinquency adjudication, they're not eligible for an enhancement under Clause 3 of the enhancement provision.
Well,
so,
I read DTP. Excuse me, Judge Conway.
Go right ahead.
I was going to say, I read DPT a little differently. That's a tongue twister. And that they were dealing, that in that case was that there was a prior adjudication. It wasn't a prior stay of adjudication. So the court was dealing with the facts as though they were presented and wrote the opinion that way. Why am I wrong when I read it that way?
Well, while the facts were a little bit different, that case involved interpretation of the very same clause at issue here, and the question was whether the child was eligible for one place. And this court explicitly drew that line of eligibility at adjudication. If this court had not done so, this court's discussion about whether DTP had a prior then clear advisory dictum. The holding that emerges from that case is that a child must have a prior adjudication to activate the enhancement.
So, Mr. Zilman, first I obviously wanted to apologize. I said Ms. West when I meant Ms. Martin. So I want to make sure I understand this. So let's say a child has 10 disorders, all of which result in a stay of adjudication, and then he's back for an 11th time. You're saying that under the statute, there would be no enhancement. Am I understanding that?
You are understanding that correct, but I would just...
Do you really think that is kind of what they wanted? I mean, as I read the statute, it's sort of like, my words, not yours. You know, everyone gets three pass, but I'm not so sure, and I would read pass as you did it, for one free pass, not that you did it and, maybe in Hennepin County did get 10 sticks of adjudication in a row because, things were different. But it's not so much the disposition, but it's whether you committed a crime. I don't know why the legislature would want to. I don't know why the legislature would want to allow people to commit ten crimes in a row, and just because they weren't adjudicated, they're still a petty offender. Why do you think the legislature would want that?
First, I would just point the court to. Juvenile disposition statute, which I believe is section 260B.198, subdivision 7 of that statute gives the juvenile court discretion to grant a stay of adjudication if it's in the child's best interest and not in the liberty of public safety. There's no limit on how many times the juvenile court will do that.
How would doing that, allowing the child to commit it, 10 crimes not be inimical to public safety so that we would not want to continue to treat him, he or she, as a petty offender?
Well, of course, it would depend on the facts of the case. It would be up to the court's discretion. And in your hypothetical, of course, created the policy that we think juveniles deserve 10 stays of adjudication without any enforcement. The legislature has said that if a juvenile court deems the child worthy of stay of adjudication, and in fact is for some reason 10 times in a row, that would be unlikely, but if that did occur, that is clearly consistent with the legislature policy. So the court would be defended accountable and at the same time balance the statutory mandated policy of providing the child with personal opportunity for personal and social growth by keeping that adjudication off the record.
The court knows the question before the court today is one of the straightforward statutory interpretation. What does the legislature mean in 260B.007 when it used the phrase previously found to have committed? But I want to start where Your Honor Judge Riley started, which is the question, what is the rule of law that the issue in this case? Because the question of statutory interpretation rises and falls on what is a common sense, reasonable rule of law that is followed. A court finds a juvenile has an offense for purposes of 260B.007, subdivision 16, when it finds that the allegations in the petition have been proved. Period. In the context.
I'm trying to understand the difference between three and four. We're talking about a misdemeanor level that would qualify.
about misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony offenses, which again, by statutory definition, would be in juvenile delinquency land subject to juvenile delinquency statutes rather than the juvenile petty offenses.
Well, a misdemeanor could be in petty offense land. We know that. That's what this provides. A misdemeanor otherwise by an adult would be a misdemeanor. I mean, a misdemeanor could be both in petty land or in delinquency land.
And by the legislature's distinct usage of the term and the reference to petty offenses in subdivision 4, that would exclusively govern the circumstances where you have what were previously deemed misdemeanor level offenses that were by statute deemed to be petty offenses. So if I were to try to put a bow on this conversation, Your Honor, again, this court need not resolve this question because the state's position, this rule of law, wouldn't have any impact on pleading guilty to a petty offense or having a trial on a petty offense because that would not be a misdemeanor level offense. That would be a juvenile petty offense by a function of the statute going forward.
So help me, and I know it's on the spot, but Judge Riley did it, so I'm going to make you do it too. What's the syllabus point? What's the rule of law that you would have us apply?
Absolutely. The first syllabus point that this court should have, and the second to last sentence that should be in the court's opinion, is a court finds a juvenile has committed an offense for purposes of 260B.007, subdivision 16C, when it finds that the allegations of the petition have been proved. And that happens at two points in time in the procedure, either at the Rule 8, when the court accepts the plea, as Judge Riley pointed out, and as happened here in 2017, or when the court issues an order on the merits of the trial under Rule 13. Under either of those circumstances, under the clear dictates of the rules of juvenile delinquency procedure and the statutes, the court must make a finding that the allegations in the charging document have been proved.
When and are the court... allegations in the document, charging document, are factual allegations?
Correct,
presumably.
Your Honor.
Okay, so how does that, and I'm sorry to harp on it, but how does your syllabus point that you just gave us, does not, how does that avoid capturing the person who committed those facts? You know, the facts are true, but by operation of statute, that would simply not be a delinquency. It would be a petty, juvenile offense.
Because in that hypothetical, if the court was receiving a plea or hearing a trial on a petty offense, the offense on which the court would make a finding is a petty offense by function of the statute.
So we need to expand, I would think, the syllabus point. Otherwise, it captures too big a universe of people, doesn't it?
I would disagree because we're talking here again about an exception to what constitutes a petty offense. Again, the baseline, I found it very confusing when I received this appeal because we're talking about an exception to an exception, really. They talk about misdemeanor level offenses under 260B.007. Then they have a juvenile exception because we want to give them more or less the benefit of the doubt. The legislature has said for these low level offenses, and they list, they enumerate them, under 16, 17, and 18, they say, look, if it would be a misdemeanor if committed by an adult, however, if it's committed by a juvenile for the first time, that baseline is a petty offense, deemed petty offense. Okay, that's the baseline rule. Then we have an exception to that rule, a few of them, one of which we're talking about here. And it says that if there is a misdemeanor level offense, again, which by definition cannot be a petty offense because it's an exception to the petty offense dictates, that where a court has made a previous finding that that offense has been committed, then it's not a juvenile petty offense for that second or enhanced offense. And so that's, again, respectfully why the state's position would not have an impact on juvenile pleading guilty or going to trial on a petty offense, because the court would never, in that circumstance, make a finding that a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor or felony offense has been committed.
So the outcome in this case, it's critically important, the nature of the underlying offense here.
Absolutely, right? Your Honor.
And maybe that's what confused me. It almost seemed like I can't find it in your brief, but it almost seemed to be sort of, oh, and by the way, it doesn't qualify under one, but it's critical that it doesn't qualify under one, under what you're telling me today, right? It's critical.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I can apologize for not drawing more attention to that. I can draw the court's attention to footnote on page 6 of our brief that talks about how fifth degree assault falls under a different exception to the petty offender rule.
Exactly.
So, right, exactly.
And it's a footnote, but it seems to me actually critically important to the operation of it under the theory that you're telling me today, right?
Absolutely, because in this case before the court today, it's uncontested that that prior offense, the 2017 offense that is being used to enhance the 2021 offense, that that was a misdemeanor level offense. It was a non-petty juvenile offense. And so that's why the record before the court today allows it to make the ruling that the state is asking it to do. And with the remaining time that I have, I do want to briefly touch on two points unless the court has any questions. First of all, the respondent is not citing those other statutes throughout the Minnesota Criminal Code that use the phrase juvenile delinquency for the purposes of in pari materia. As the prosecuting authority, I want to be very clear. It is our position that the statute is unambiguous. The court need not look at other statutes to interpret the plain language of what is required for a judicial finding. Rather, the state cites those under the framework that's best set forth in the Seagate Tech decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision for 2014 that said it in our brief. That talks about that it's fundamental to any statutory interpretation case that distinctions in language used in the same context must be presumed to be intentional. Stated differently, courts like this one have to presume that when the legislature uses distinctly different language in similar contexts, that it must mean different things. That is a framework of analysis for statutory interpretation that this court can use for unambiguous statutes. And that's to say that when the legislature wants to make an adjudication of delinquency as the precondition before enhancing a subsequent offense, it knows full well how to write a statute to do that. Its declination to do so under 260B.007 is thus evidence that that is not what it intended in using the more broader or the more flexible and broader language of just a judicial finding that the allegation has been or that the offense has been committed. And then finally, briefly, I do want to talk about
an offense that would qualify for delinquency
as a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony offense. Yes,
that would be, and I'm focused on misdemeanor, but a misdemeanor that would qualify as a petty, as a for delinquency, not for a petty, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
We do need to read that part of the state's argument into it. It strikes me.
I agree, Your Honor. Whether the court describes that as a non-petty offense or whether the court describes these as a category offenses that are accepted or exempted from being a petty offense, Your Honor's point is absolutely right. We are only talking about here on the rule that we're advocating for is that non-petty offenses like the one at bar in 2017, even regardless of if there's no adjudication of delinquency, they nevertheless have a judicial finding that the offense committed and that therefore may be used to enhance the subsequent offense.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Just wanna touch on a few points. And the most overarching point that I would like to draw the court's attention to is that first that the state's argument here really only shows that there feasibly could be two different interpretations of the statute here. Of course, this court already decided that the appellant's interpretation is the most reasonable one in DTP. But other problems with the state's argument is that the state's argument rests on court rules that refer to the allegations in the charging document being proven, not to whether the child committed the offense, which of course is different language. And of course, that language comes from court rules, which was not enacted by the legislature and which doesn't go to the legislature's intent, especially in the absence of some sort of express reference to the statute here in the court rules or a reference to the court rules in the statute. But you won't find any such references. I think as Judge Riley pointed out, there's a finding of guilt after acceptance of the plea. But then at the disposition hearing, that's when the court adjudicates the child delinquent and enters a disposition. And as we noted in our brief, that is a completely separate finding. And the state's position does not point the court to which finding is the one that the enhancement provision refers to. As we noted, though, of course, under this court's case law, under principles of statutory interpretation, as well as under controlling policy considerations, the appellant's interpretation is the correct one. And I would actually, with respect to the state citation to Seagate Tech, we think that is actually, refutes the state's position, because in Seagate Tech, the Supreme Court was discussing how when the legislature uses the same word or phrase in the same statute, we can infer that the legislature meant the same thing by that word or phrase. However, the state is looking at completely different statutes to try to clarify the plain language of the statute at issue here, which is just, that's not how that works. And in fact, under Seagate, I would actually point the court to back to clauses 3 and 4 of the enhancement provisions. And as I mentioned, clause 4, which requires 2 adjudications of a petty offender, we can prove that it requires an adjudication. We know that the phrase found to have committed under clause 4 can refer to nothing but an adjudication. And so it would fly in the face of how plain meaning is understood and applied.
Why do you say that? Why do you think the language to have committed a misdemeanor level juvenile petty offense? Why do you think that the key word that's missing from both of these is adjudication? And I see your argument is saying there must be an adjudication. And I see the state's argument is what would the adjudication have been? But neither one talks about adjudication. It seems so. I'm wondering about that statement that it requires an adjudication.
Sure. As I mentioned, in the context of Chapter 260B, when referring to adjudications, the legislature often does not use the word adjudicate. In fact, when it's referring to the adjudication phase, both in the juvenile disposition statute and the juvenile petty offense statute, it used a derivative of the phrase found to have committed in each case to refer to the adjudication. As I mentioned with respect to the juvenile petty offense statute, the legislature expressly clarified there that if the court finds that a child committed a second or subsequent controlled substance offense, tobacco offense, or driving offense, that the court can impose various enhanced dispositions on the, quote, adjudicated petty offender. And so we know that that child who has been found to have committed an offense is necessarily adjudicated. Now, if we tie that back to clause 4 of the enhancement provision, which uses the same language to refer to to juvenile petty offenses, we know that clause 4 requires an adjudication. And indeed, the juvenile petty offense statute does not contain any provision to allow the court to grant a stay of adjudication. So it would appear that the legislature only contemplated that a child is found to have committed a petty offense when the child is adjudicated a petty offender. And so we can prove.
So I can understand what you just said. Are you saying that that a juvenile court lacks authority to stay the adjudication of an offense that would be a petty?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. At least within the context of the statute, the legislature has given the courts no authority to do that. And so we know that because Clause 4 requires an adjudication and it uses the same triggering language as Clause 3, that Clause 3 also requires an adjudication of delinquency. And I see my time is up, so unless the court has more questions, I would ask for the relief requested in the briefs.
Very good. Thank you both. Excellent oral arguments, excellent briefs. I appreciate your being here, Mr. Zillman, as a student attorney especially. And thank you both. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statutory time period.
Judge Smith, may I say something?
Oh, of course.
So I have great hope for the future of the legal profession, having watched Mr. Zillman as a law student.
Thank you so much, Judge. I really appreciate that.
Is anyone expecting, are you ready to go a couple minutes early, or is anyone expecting someone to join them who's not here from counsel?
Morning, Ryan. Yes, Ryan Hatton for appellants.
And are you ready to go, Mr. Hatton, if we start a minute early?
Yeah.
Okay. And Mr. Pfau?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm ready as well.
How do you pronounce your last name, please?
You got it right, Your Honor. Pfau.
Pfau. Very good. Okay. Well, I think we're ready to, and Melissa and Marshall sort of to start things off here then.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Connolly, Judge Riley, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are on our second or third of our oral cases on today's calendar. The case before us is A21-1215 Advantage Financial LLC Appellant versus Janice C. Marshall as trustee for the Janice C. Marshall Revocable Trust et al. Respondents. Counsel, we're conducting this argument via Zoom, and an audio recording will appear later on our website as per usual. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. At the start of your arguments, if you could please state your name and a party or parties you represent. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you choose to use it, the clock is there. Hopefully you can see it. And we are ready for counsel for appellant, if you're ready to go.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ryan Hatton, H-A-T-T-O-N, Gerstel Law Firm, appearing on behalf of Appellant Advantage Financial, LLC. We're here to review the district court's reversal of a confession of judgment that was entered by court administration. Confessions of judgment are intended to be judicially efficient mechanisms to enter a voluntary judgment administratively, governed by Minnesota Statute Section 548.22. A judgment may be entered in the district court by confession without action upon filing with the court administrator a statement signed and verified by defendants. In this case, the court administrator properly entered judgment against respondents based upon the filing of a signed and verified statement.
Mr. Hatton, what do you think verified means?
Verified means that there's a separate verification that's attached to the confession, attesting that the confession judgment debtor has read, understands, and attests to the facts that are set out in the confession of judgment. Notably, the statute that governs confessions does not require that the confession or verification be signed, or excuse me, be dated. In this case, both the confession and the verification were signed by the judgment debtors.
So what facts do you believe have to be contained in this verification? Just who owes the money, who or she owes it to, how much they owe? I mean, what are the facts that have to be put in?
I think the verification can really refer to the contents of the confession itself and say, I've read and understood facts set out in the confession and agree that they are true, right? We don't need to have a full recitation of facts in the confession, the statement itself, and then regurgitate all of those same facts in the verification that's signed and made part of the confession. So it's an incorporation by reference, really, but it's an acknowledgement that yes, I've read it, I understood it, and it's true, basically.
If there's a date, normally, no one wants a judgment without interest on it, and interest has a tendency to compound. Wouldn't it be important to have dates in the documents you're talking about to determine how and when interest is calculated and from what date?
I suppose from a best practices perspective, it wouldn't hurt, but we're really, a confession is signed at a point in time where it's usually a contingent liability. So like, for example, in this case, there's a settlement agreement that sets out a certain payment of stream. And at that same time, the confession of judgment is executed as security for the payments to be made pursuant to the settlement agreement. So having the dates in a confession or the verification really won't have an impact on the interest that you're speaking about, because where that would come in to play is as part of entering the confession of judgment with court administrator, the attorney or creditor needs to set out the basis or the default as to why the confession is being entered. For example, here, there is a settlement agreement which required the payment of a specified sum by a specified date. There is no debate or argument that that payment was not made. Based on that default and as authorized in the settlement agreement, the confession with the verification was filed along with an affidavit of default setting out the grounds under which it was agreed that the confession could be entered.
Mr. Hatton, I'm looking at both the first confession of judgment and the verification for that. And I see that on the first confession of judgment, the Marshall and Schmidt signatures were notarized, but that on the verification, they're not. And I just note that it's interesting to me because presumably they were signed at the same time, although we don't know because the dates are missing from the verification.
Right. There's not a requirement that the verification be notarized. There's not a requirement in the statute that it needs to be dated. If the legislature had intended those requirements to be material to a valid confession of judgment, it easily could have included those requirements in the statute. And if you step back and take a look at how these documents are executed in the real world, settlement agreements and confession of judgments are crafted and agreed to by counsel, and typically, right, the defendant or judgment debtor is going to be signing the settlement agreements and confessions of judgments with their own counsel, usually in this world of remote settings being then emailed to other parties. And so it's really the debtor's own counsel that is facilitating the mechanism for executing these documents. And that is why both the settlement agreement and the confession of judgment itself includes waiver language to protect the creditor against there being some administrative imperfection in the execution of the documents, which were agreed to. And again, in this case, the record is devoid of any argument that defendants didn't sign, you know, arguments saying we didn't sign the confession, we didn't sign the verification. They did. They did it as part of a settlement agreement, and they received the benefit of that settlement agreement by having 3 years of federal court litigation in Illinois resolved. And then they presented to the court in Illinois that, yes, our settlement agreement's final. All the documents referenced in that settlement agreement have been executed, right? And so you can't come back now and months later say, court vacate the judgment. It should not have been entered administratively. There should have been a hearing. That's really what the decision that the court is looking to
reverse. Let's say, for the sake of argument, we don't agree with you and we affirm the district court. How would your client then attempt to collect the money? What would happen next on your part? What would you do? Would there just be a hearing?
Yeah, there would be a hearing on the confession of judgment, because what the district court said in vacating the judgment was that it should not have been entered administratively without a hearing. So if you were to affirm, it would put us back in the place where we would go to the district court and have a hearing on the confession of judgment. And there's no meritorious defense to not entering the judgment upon a hearing, because as set out in the briefs, there's not a sufficient grounds to reverse or vacate the judgment, which means that there would not be grounds to avoid entering the judgment upon a hearing. If
you're saying, since there are no facts in dispute, well, from your perspective, he did owe the money, he didn't pay the margin account, he signed the confession of judgment, the hearing would be, I don't know, I guess I don't want to say a waste of time, but certainly perfunctory.
Correct, right. It's an exercise in futility. Holding a hearing would be judiciously inefficient. I mean, the margin account was, three.
God knows at the Court of Appeals, we certainly don't want to encourage that. But I mean, at the end of the day, the flip side is, this is an administrative procedure.
Correct.
Swift and certain.
Correct.
Because it's so powerful. I mean, it's just a court administrator checking some boxes and then magically, a judgment's entered and, the interest starts running. Why wouldn't we want to insist on absolute strict compliance with having all the dates entered so that there's no confusion? And so that, down the road, someone doesn't say, well, wait a minute, I didn't really sign that. It's not, I was supposed to have more time. It was a different date. I mean, why?
No, yeah, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and my response.
So why am I wrong?
The statute doesn't require dates in the confession, and judgment interest begins to run upon entry of the judgment, not entry of the dates in the confession of judgment. So the date, whether or not the verification has the month written, not the day, and the confession itself has both the month and the day, and someone says, well, they're mismatched.
What if the date said November 2028? No difference?
No difference. That's a hypothetical. That's not these facts here. But
believe me, I grasp that. I don't grasp a lot of things, but I grasp that what I'm giving you is not
okay.
Is fiction.
Right.
But I mean, that would be even more concern, wouldn't it? I mean, then it's like, well, wait a minute, would be me anyway.
No, but because the confession only becomes effective when the affidavit of default is signed and the judgment, confession, and verification with the affidavit of default are presented to the court for entry of judgment, because it's the entry of judgment then, not when the confession and verification were signed, that are operative in beginning to accrue post-judgment interest on that entered judgment. And in this case, there is simply no valid grounds presented to the district court as part of the motion to vacate the judgment, which would give the court reason to deny the entry of this confession of judgment, right? There is no affidavit providing that the judgment had been paid. That would be a reason for it not to be entered, that they didn't sign it or that the signatures were procured by fraud. That's not the case. That was not provided to the district court to review. It didn't happen. That's something.
I don't know if this is in the record. Does the settlement agreement have a merger clause in it?
By merger clause, what are you referring to?
I mean that this is the sole agreement and, it's binding and it can't be amended unless it's in writing. Does it have language like that in it?
I would have to review that document. Okay. That's not a document.
Because presumably if it didn't, then arguably at this hearing that might take place, if we affirm the district court, then the debtor could say, well, wait, actually, they told me that if I was sick, I'd get an extra 6 months or something like that.
Right.
And so therefore the dates are critical.
Yeah.
You know,
I will look and I would assume that it does, as this was a very negotiated thing.
Settlement agreement in the record. I mean, we actually have people who can look too. Is that in the record?
I believe it is.
Okay.
It is.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
And again, both the settlement agreement and the confession of judgment include waiver language saying there is no reason to, my time is up, to not enter judgment.
Judge Connolly, does that answer your questions?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to ask one question before, just for a moment. So, maybe I've forgotten. Was this judgment, there was a hearing in this case, right? I mean, the order followed a hearing.
There was a hearing on respondent's motion to vacate the judgment.
Okay, I'm just looking at the order vacating judgment. It says that it's on plaintiff's motion to enter judgment and defendant's motion to quash it, garnish it. So there was an administrative entry of judgment, and then there was a hearing following it on the motion to vacate, right?
Correct. So yes, the judgment was entered administratively.
Yes.
And post entry of judgment, there was a motion. There were cross motions with respect to a third party garnishment,
right?
Which we're asking the court to remand back, but that was not the subject of the appeal. What's the subject of the appeal is the district court's grant of respondent's motion to vacate the entered confession.
Okay, thank you. And then you can mute yourself. Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. Pfau.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Pfau, and I'm counsel for respondents Janice Marshall and Kevin Schmidt, both as trustees of the Janice Marshall Trust, and Kevin Schmidt individually. The narrow issue here is whether the district court abused its discretion by vacating the judgment under the residual clause for relief from the defective confession of judgment in this matter. The court did not. That is why respondents respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's vacation of judgment. The district court correctly applied the law in finding that the first confession of judgment was not properly verified consistent with statutory requirements under Minnesota Statute 548.22. The statute requires a judgment for money due may be entered in the district court by confession upon filing with the court administrator a statement signed and verified by defendant.
So, counsel, let me ask, if the court administrator had decided, oh, I'm not sure about this, and under the handbook language that's there, the district court decides to have an order and whether to, in fact, enter judgment based on the confession of judgment, what are the disputed issues of fact that would have taken place that would have been at issue in such a hearing?
Sure. The disputed issues of fact, first of all, for the first opportunity that then counsel had to cure was the different documents. So it was for a first confession of judgment, yet this document that has the verification is for a third confession of document.
Right, so, but what's the district court trying to decide? In other words, is the issue, hey, did they sign this? Or is the issue, what date did they sign it? And why does it matter? What does the district court have to decide to determine whether in fact a confession of judgment is verified at an evidentiary hearing?
Sure. So the reason for the verification is to know the truth, is to understand whether and ascertain whether the debtor knew what they were signing on to. So it is the point of verifying something is not leaving any box unchecked.
So Mr. Pfau, I, Kevin Schmidt, having read the first confession of judgment and fully understanding the contents of the document and the legal consequences of its contents, do hereby acknowledge that the signature that appears on the document is mine and that I signed the document of my own free will on November No Day 2020. So what, beyond that, what would the judge be wanting to hear or needing to hear in order to enter judgment?
So in this particular case, I think with respect to instances of whether he, his illness is ongoing serious medical issues.
But the issue I have with that is the chronology. As I understand it, he was hospitalized. I mean, he had a series of really serious medical issues, but they happened more in October. And by November, he was out of the hospital and presumably knew if he was getting better quickly or not.
Sure. So if I may go back to the first point, the importance of the date in the verification is to ascertain which day that they actually verified the document and the statement of fact to which the debt arose, so that if there are disputes of fact as to medical issues, as to cognitive ability, you are able to pinpoint and ascertain the exact date of verification so that you know whether they truly were verifying in their fullest mental capacity on that day and their fullest physical ability on that day. And so that is the reason for the importance of...
You know, this is the first time, and perhaps I'm wrong, that I've been hearing some issue relating to... It's not just he was sick, it's just that somehow he did not have the cognitive ability to sign the verification. I mean, is that an argument, A, that's in your brief, and B, that you raised below?
No, Your Honor, I didn't mean to confuse you.
No, that's all right. Because I mean, that does ring a bell for me. I mean, if there's some suggestion, you know, he was mentally incapacitated, then you know, and I mean, does the settlement agreement say, oh, by the way, if you're sick, you get an extra 6 months? Is there anything like that in the agreement?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, that there is no such clause as that.
So, I mean, for me, it's like, you know, certainly I'm sorry that your client was ill, seriously ill. And that's, you know, I don't wish that on anybody, but, you know, and I don't mean to be blunt, but, you know, he had a margin account. He didn't cover the margin. He didn't pay the debt. The settlement agreement gave him some time to pay the debt. If you don't, hence the confession of judgment, you know, that's kind of the hammer. And I mean, there doesn't seem to be any dispute that he owes the money and that, and you know, so whether we do this in an administrative or hearing, I don't see what facts are in dispute that somehow this should keep going on. So why am I wrong, counsel?
Your Honor, the respondents here are not in any way trying to abandon or forsake their obligations under the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement is clear, and we're not here to relitigate the settlement agreement, but there was the date of the initial down payment. There was communication that the record showed between counsel on with the ongoing medical issues, how he thought he may have been able to come up with the down payments that ultimately didn't come about because he couldn't get the income from his farm. But regardless of that, what we are saying here is the confession of judgment was not properly verified. So statutorily, it is defect. Respondents did not intend to waiver statutory protections or statutory procedures. And so vacating this judgment had no ill effect on the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement stands. The settlement agreement is separate from the first confession of judgment.
So, counsel, may I ask, had the court administrator not entered it, and there was then a hearing before the district court to decide whether it was, I guess, in fact, verified, but I haven't going to come back to that question. And your client said, I signed this verification on November 25th. Then what? Can it be entered? Or does the court, district court, lack authority in your view to enter the judgment once the missing date is ascertained?
Good question, Your Honor. So as that court administration handbook so clearly laid out the procedural steps, you know, these are essentially, if you want to call them safety procedures, I don't know, to make sure that every T is crossed and every I is dotted, the court administrator would have sent that deficiency notice, giving the attorney a chance to cure. And so if what the court administrator was sent back was a properly verified form, then absolutely enter it administratively as they should. If the form was still defective in a way, then yes, a hearing needs to be scheduled and heard so that the court can ultimately enter the judgment.
So a court could enter that if the evidence comes out, it was on November 25th. Okay, matter solved. The court can enter the judgment at that point in time in your view. The date question is resolved.
Yes, Your Honor. This is really what we're trying to get at is, you know, yes, a pinpoint date might seem so minuscule, but it is because that this is administratively entered. All the boxes have to be checked. There has to be absolute certainty because Mr. Hatton was correct. These confessions of judgment are meant as a judicial efficient way to go about, you know, resolving these debts. And so it allows the actual courts to take a step back and let the administrative process flow. But because the courts take a step back, we need to ensure that every single box is checked, even the day it was signed and verified. And so,
I have just a procedural question. Sure. There was a motion with regard to the garnishment that still remains outstanding. And appellant says that you didn't really respond to that and probably agree that the case needs to go back at the very least to deal with the garnishment issue. Do you agree with that?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I see that the vacating the order based on this defective confession of judgment was dispositive of the whole thing. The confession of judgment is the foundation to which the garnishment is built off of. Without the confession of judgment, there is no reason to discuss the garnishment.
And as I understand the record, your client was supposed to pay $50,000 the beginning of December, didn't. And then in January, wired $25,000 to his attorney in Chicago, I believe.
Correct. That was the attorney that represented him during the negotiations of that settlement from federal court. We have had not very many dealings with that attorney, Your Honor, but he did wire the $25,000 in an attempt to show good faith negotiation that he was trying. He was trying. He knows he missed this December 1st deadline. He was communicative despite his medical issues with,
So let me ask you this, because in the district court, you brought up your client's health issues and the judge's order didn't talk about that at all. She focused on the verification and the procedural issues with that. And so I'm looking at Rule 60.02, and which of the subsections do you think your client's, or do you think the judge just didn't think that your client's health issues mattered with regard to vacating or not this default judgment? And if, in your mind, if you were able to argue health issues, which of the subsections would that come under? Is that the excusable neglect or subsection A? Where does it come on? Which subsection?
So the district court judge in her findings of fact did acknowledge his ongoing serious medical issues. And when you look at the opinion, the true determinative factor was the defective confession of judgment. And so, you know, the residual clause is that catch-all, equitable, you know, for reasons justifying equity. So, you know, in a way you could come into the aggregate that the illness on top of the defective confession of judgment would fit under the residual clause. Strictly speaking, I know of cases that the illness typically falls under excusable neglect. However, in this instance, there really, I don't see neglect on the part of the respondents to their obligations under the settlement agreement, as the record shows that they were trying to get the down payment in working order, you know, to the best of their ability. Your Honor, your.
So there's no affidavit from your client saying, you know, but for my illness, I would have made the rest of the payment on time as required by the settlement agreement. Is that a fair statement, counsel?
Your Honor, I don't know exactly what, or I don't know, remember the exact language of the affidavit, but I do remember him discussing the ways in which he was trying to raise the funds and the ways in which his ongoing medical issues prevented him and obstructed him from obtaining those funds. I know I am running out of, if you had one more question. I know I'm running out of time, so I can just have a quick closing. To your honors, the equity weighed heavily in favor of respondents here. The confession of judgment did not meet the statutory requirements for administrative entry of judgment. A chance to cure was given. It was ineffectual. No hearing was held or scheduled. Thus, I respectfully ask the court to affirm the district court's vacation of the judgment against plaintiff appellant. Thank you, your honors.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
I can click the right unmute box would be helpful. Thank you, counsel, court. To address Judge Conley's question regarding integration clauses within the settlement agreement, I can answer that in the affirmative. I'll point the court to page 11 of 17, bullet points C and E. C is an integration clause, and E is a no amendment except in writing. Council refers to administratively checking the boxes. The legislature is the body that determines which boxes need to be checked. And it did so in expressing its will, signed by the governor through the statute 548.22. The legislature did not create a date box to be checked. None is required. The confession and verification are proper and comply with the plain language of the statute, period. Here, court administration followed the processes and procedures set out to ensure that a confession of judgment is properly verified before entering the judgment. It sent a notice of deficiency, which was responded to appropriately by counsel, providing the verification that aligned with the confession the court was asked to enter, reviewing that documentation and the affidavit of default. Court administration was satisfied that all of the necessary statutory boxes were checked and entered judgment. It should be noted that both the confession and the verification do contain the month date, and that there is no dispute that the confession of judgment and settlement agreement, which references the confession of judgment, were both signed by respondents before the date of performance was due. Performance was due December 1. There's no dispute that both the settlement agreement and the confession of judgment with its verification were executed before the date of obligation arose. It's also noted that the settlement agreement was signed about 11 or 12 days before obligation, the date of obligation. There's nothing in the record to suggest that anything happened that was unforeseen in the intervening time period, which would give cause or reason for relief from the obligations under the settlement agreement, and that by defaulting under the settlement agreement, the respondents earned the judgment that they confessed to. Had there been something, we wouldn't be here. It would have been presented to the district court. There are no extraordinary circumstances. The savings clause in Rule 6002 does not provide sufficient grounds for relief. The equities in this case favor the appellant. The appellant resolved its federal court litigation at a significant discount in reliance on the settlement agreement, and that it expected to be paid a modicum of what was due and owing by December 1, and it did not receive a payment.
Mr. Hatton, you agree that under the Buck Blacktop case, that since the judge found that subsection F was a subsection that applied, the judge did not need to make Findon findings.
I agree. Findon findings under that are not required. However, I will note that there's still the requirement that movement demonstrate defense on the merits, right? If there is no defense on the merits, then it's just an exercise of kabuki theater, because we go back and we have a hearing and judgment is entered. With that, I ask the court to reverse the district court's vacation of the entry of the confession of judgment and remand to the district court for consideration of the cross motions with respect to the third party garnishment.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments today. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Have a good
day. Thank you, Your Honors, counsel. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you, counsel.
We are here for our last of three cases on our oral calendar this morning. This case is A20-1364, State of Minnesota, Respondent versus James David Wren, Appellant. Also A21-0726. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. At the start of it, I'd ask that you state your name and the party you represent for the record. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And also know that this is a Zoom argument. I'll just make that note for the record. The audio recording will be posted later on our website. And counsel for appellant, if you are ready to begin, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Paul Ceratori, and I represent the appellant, James Wren, in this appeal. Mr. Wren has brought four issues before the court in his appeal, the most important being the trial court's violation of his right to a speedy trial, which my argument today will mainly focus. The right to a speedy trial is guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment, and by a rule, a trial must commence within 60 days unless good cause is shown, and then no longer than 120 days unless exigent circumstances exist. If it goes past the 120 days, the defendant must be released on non-monetary bail. Here, Mr. Wren was not brought to trial before 256 days had elapsed. All 256 days were not attributed to the state or the court, but based upon Mr. Wren's reluctant acquiescence to toll the time from November of 2019 until the March 16th trial date, because his new counsel, the court, the public defender had to be brought up to speed on the case and review the voluminous amounts of discovery in a first degree murder case as this was. That leaves 141 days that were attributable to the state and the court based upon the state's request for a continuance of the March 16th trial date, based upon, among other things, childcare and the COVID-19 pandemic that had just hit in March of 2020.
Mr. Saratori, can I just follow up with you there? I agree with you that the speedy request was told during the defendant's acquiescence to a delay. But my calculation is that the delay would be from March 16, 2020 through the start of trial, which is, I think, June 15th. Is that right? Was that the start of trial?
Trial was started June 15th. That would have been 91 days. However, We do have the time from when he actually first demanded speedy trial, which would be added on to that prior to the November date when he agreed to toll the time from November until the March 16th trial date.
So that would be from October 3rd until November,
I believe, 19 or so. The numbers, I think both the briefs, my brief as well as the as respondents' brief, talk about the time and are pretty clear on the time. It's give or take a few days, but we're looking about 140 to 141 days that wouldn't have been told by that agreement by Mr. Wren.
So he asserted a speedy in November or in October, but no one was ready to go to trial during that time. I mean, he fired his attorney, isn't that right?
Well, he didn't actually fire his attorney. That's a little bit harsh. It was actually a mutual agreement. His regular counsel he has had for many years said he wouldn't represent him, so he let him off the case.
Okay.
And then at that time, Mr. Wren applied for a public defender and Brian Leary was appointed. I would note that the court initially talked about a January 21st trial date, but that trial date, all parties agree that that probably wouldn't happen because of the indictment that was coming, as well as the fact that there was voluminous amounts of discovery. So that's why Mr. Wren then in November, once Mr. Leary came on board, agreed to push it to the March 16th date.
Okay, thank you.
So then on March 6th, so if we look at the factors laid out in Barker versus Wingo, which is the seminal case based upon the Sixth Amendment's right to a speedy trial, we look at four factors. We've all agreed that, I believe the respondents agreed, even the trial courts agreed that Mr. Wren was past the 90 days, past the 120 days to trigger further analysis. Then we have number two, which is the reason for the delay, which is an argument here. Three, whether the defendant asserted his right to a speedy trial, which I believe everybody agrees, I shouldn't believe, it is true that everybody agrees he asserted his right to a speedy trial more than once, and whether the delay prejudiced the defendant. Now the state argues that reason two, the reason for the delay was neutral based upon COVID. Mr. Wren disagrees with that. On March 16th, 2020, all parties were ready to go to trial. A jury was brought in.
Mr. Saratori, I mean, we have a precedent from this court saying that it is not attributable to either the state or the defendant, that it's neutral. So, I mean, isn't that dispositive?
It is not, Your Honor, and this is the reason why. Number one, the cases that you're referencing, State v. Jackson, State v. Bell, State v. Preston, State v. Randall, and State v. Page, are all distinguishable from this case. Number two, there's an additional factor here that the court must consider, and that is the order from Judge Gilday that ongoing trials and high priority cases must go forward. Mr. Wren was ready to pick a jury on March 16th. The juries were sworn as to a jury questionnaire, were answering questions, and arguably were impaneled in the sense that they were 71 or 61 jurors were brought in and ready to be chosen through voir dire. So that is a little bit different. Now, I granted, if we were just talking about the pandemic and what this court has said was a neutral reason, I would agree, it would be dispositive, but we're not talking about that. This is a different case. We're talking about a case that is distinguishable. in the fact that we had the March 13th, 2020 order from Judge Gilday, who said ongoing trials must go forward and high priority cases, especially ones that deal with a constitutional right, as we were talking about with Mr. Wren, must go forward. And Judge Angus ignored that.
So can I ask a question? I know this wasn't necessarily briefed by the state, but my question is when the jury is brought in to begin answering a questionnaire, does that mean under the rules of criminal procedure that the trial has started for purposes of a speedy?
That's a good question. It's a question I've been searching for
in my
litigation. Yeah, you're welcome. Not that you need me to affirm that, but we talk about impaneling a jury. Now, impaneling a jury would mean that in a sense of double jeopardy attaching, the jury would be sworn, picked, and sworn. In this case, the jury had brought in, I think we're talking about more of it, was the trial in progress? We argue that the trial was in progress. As for a speedy trial, that would not really factor in the fact that the trial was not allowed to go forward and not be completed. Double jeopardy is not attached. So I would argue that the trial has not reached the point where it can't be stopped. It's the reason why it was stopped, if that makes sense.
It makes sense.
So,
can I ask you another question? I'm sorry to monopolize your time here, but the Chief Justice's order suspending trials allowed for the pilot to begin sometime in May or June. So even if we say that trials could recommence in May or June, and his trial did commence within 45 days of the pilot being adopted, how does that impact your analysis?
Well, arguably it would still be past the 60, but it wouldn't be past the 120. I don't think we would reach to the level of the exigent circumstance. It's funny you bring that up, because when Mr. Wren was first up, according to Judge English, and they still continued him because he was first up for the pilot, and they still continued him for other lower level cases that ended up not even going. The record is clear of that in the transcripts that will talk about that, especially the one from May 21st, page 4, where Judge English said that this is the first case to go first forward. This is the one that's going forward on the pilot program. Though arguably it would be a good cause versus an exigent circumstances argument, because I think we would be within the 120 if we dropped it back, say, 45 days. It was very interesting that the state has called factors 2 and factors 4 neutral, where the lower court arguably said that they were all Mr. Wren's fault. The delay was Mr. Wren's fault. One of the arguments that the state brings up is that Mr. Wren filed a motion to dismiss, which would normally weigh against Mr. Wren in that case, or against the defendant. Well, that is a specious argument, because that was done during the time that Mr. Wren had agreed to toll the statute of limitations. That was filed in January, and the decision came out in February prior to the March 16th date. So that argument falls flat. The second one was the DOC hold. Their argument was, because Mr. Wren was being held on a DOC warrant, that he wasn't going to be released anyway. Well, that is another specious argument, because it ignores the regs. The regs are very clear that once a warrant is put out with regards to a parolee violating parole, the determination on that warrant does not kick in until either bail is set on the underlying case that is violating his parole, or the new case is dealt with. So that furthers Mr. Wren's argument.
I'm sorry, counsel. What are those regs? Can you give
it's Minnesota Rule 2940.3100. It states, at any time the releasee is prepared to make bail or has been sentenced by the court, the supervising agent shall submit a written formal recommendation to the executive officer, hearings and release regarding whether to maintain the warrant or allow the releasee to make bail, or to cancel the warrant, allow a local sentence to be imposed, obviously, if he has been sentenced. So that argument falls flat.
He didn't make bail. Is that a fair statement?
Well, no, he couldn't pay the $1 or $2 million bail, and he should have been released with non-monetary conditions, which would have been proper. They could have put a tracking device on him. They could have given up his passport. There's many things they could have done. He could not afford the $2 million bail. Obviously, he had a public defender.
So I was wondering, Mr. Serratori, if you could move to the prejudice argument. What is the prejudice your client suffered?
Well, there's a couple parts of the prejudice, Your Honor. And first, one of Mr. Wren's key witnesses, Kyle Culberson, was murdered. He was murdered on March 22nd, 2020. Now, the state.
And was there an offer of proof at any point as to what that individual would have testified to in terms of, you know,
There was not an offer of proof, Your Honor. However, he was all over the police reports and the videos. So I think making an offer of proof either way, he was on the state's witness list as well as the defendant's witness list. So I don't know what offer of proof would need other than the videos.
Well, I mean, okay, so he was, but I mean, was he going to say something like, I did it, or instead of your client, or like, I saw someone else do it? I mean, I'm looking for, you know, clearly it was a tragedy that he died, but what, had he been alive, what is the evidence that his testimony would have helped your client?
Your Honor, I could only speculate as to what would happen, but Mr. Wren brought a self-defense claim. Mr. Culberson was with Mr. Wren. Mr. Wren's testimony was that he was defending himself as well as others. And that was the reason why he ended up shooting the two individuals. So Mr. Culberson would offer that additional testimony to bolster Mr. Wren's position that he was acting in self-defense. Now the state wants to argue—
Well, that's an assumption, isn't it? I mean—
Well, we're all making assumptions. Mr. Culberson—
Well, I know, but I mean, in order for it to be, I mean, it seems to me in order to prove that, you know, I was prejudiced, Casey died, he would have testified, however he would have testified in some manner that would have made it, well, that would have helped. I wouldn't even say it would have made a difference, would have helped your client. I mean, there's no evidence of that in the record, is there?
Well, I believe there is, Your Honor. I mean, there's, from what was brought up, I mean, there's the evidence in the record of the videos and the transcripts and the testimony of others that he was present. Secondly, I would note, I wasn't the trial attorney, but I would note that a lot was talked about what we could talk, what the people in trial could talk about as it related to Mr. Culberson, because they didn't want to bring out that he was murdered. So it's tough to say that the record would have a lot of information other than the police reports and the videos that had Mr. Culberson in them, because they didn't want to allude to the fact that he was murdered a day before the trial would have been started on March 22nd. So again, I think we're all making assumptions about what he would say other than the fact that he was present. He would have offered the fact that he was part of the group that was being attacked by the alleged victims in this case, and was the one that Mr. Wren was defending at that time. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes, excuse me, for rebuttal too. Counsel for respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's convictions because his constitutional right to a speedy trial was not violated by the extenuating circumstances of the pandemic. Furthermore, the district court did not abuse its discretion in giving a jury instruction for a lesser included offense or by ordering appellant to pay restitution. Finally, because appellant has not met his burden of proof that his attorney's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, or that the outcome would have been different, this court should find that appellant was not denied effective assistance of counsel. At this time, I'm happy to address any questions that the panel may have.
Ms. Vokes, when we are talking about the delay that occurred because of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's my understanding that part of that delay was the Chief Justice's order, and then part of that delay was because of some scheduling conflicts that the prosecutor in the case had. Is that right?
So if you're talking about from March 16th at that point?
I am.
My read of the record is that the delay is based on the pandemic, and then it's based on, so both obviously Chief Justice Gilday's orders, but then also restrictions by the Minnesota Judicial Council. I think that it's clear from the transcripts and some of, and from Judge Ingish's orders about the speedy trial motions that governing body was determining how to go forward. And even the district court said that it was kind of out of her hands in terms of when they started in that pilot project. And so in the state's view, those delays are the pandemic, and then also sort of a subset of the pandemic is the Judicial Council determining how to go forward with the appropriate protocols, protections, all the things that needed to be done to make sure that jury trials could be conducted in a safe manner. And then there was sort of that additional piece of the Judicial Council determining that a 2-week first degree murder case is probably not an appropriate test case essentially for, do we have the right protocol if, halfway through the trial, we end up with a mistrial related to, some sort of COVID problem, maybe it should be on a shorter, less serious, less high stakes case, just try to run a shorter jury trial and make sure that everything is in place. That's my read of the record based on those orders.
All right, thank you.
So Ms. Folks, Mr. Ceratori makes a point that, we were kind of semi ready to go and the Chief Justice's order didn't kick in yet. So what should we, I'm certainly not going to second guess the district court, but I suppose there's no evidence in the record that, the whole courtroom was ready with the plexiglass and, the wipes and all that stuff. So it's not just, why didn't you just get started? It was more like, we can't get started until we sort of know what we're doing. Would that be a fair statement, Ms. Folks?
Are you talking about when the motion was made on March 16th to continue? Absolutely. Yes. I think that at the point, at March 16th, obviously the state had its witnesses subpoenaed. The state was ready to go. But the state made the motion because none of those protocol were in place at that time. I think that the news about the pandemic was changing on a daily basis. It was obviously a brand new emergency situation. And I think that looking at Judge Engish's orders, it's clear that a lot of that planning for, the plexiglass, which courtrooms are we going to use? How many courtrooms can we open? Masking, where will they deliberate? How will we present exhibits? The transcripts are pretty clear that there's a lot of ongoing discussions. And I think that's the primary reason that, in addition to stay-at-home orders, that no jury trials were starting until June 1st, because none of that was in place until, they could consult with the health authorities and figure out what the safest way was to proceed in sort of an unprecedented public health emergency.
Ms. Folks, I'd like to sort of shift a little bit to the prejudice part. Would you explain to me the implication of the detainer? Because your position is, he would have been in anyway. How does that relate to Mr. Ceratori's point? Maybe he would have made bail would you sort of explain the interplay between that? And is it as simple as that? He violated parole, or there's an allegation he violated parole, presumably, I imagine, because of these charges, and therefore that's all we look at. Tough. He's in anyway, so it doesn't matter that he's in on this.
So the reason that the state raised that sort of angle on that is simply because when you're looking at prejudice, there's those three different factors, those three different types of prejudice. And so arguably, if he would have been held on the detainer anyway, you wouldn't consider the first two types. But I think in this case, if this court doesn't feel comfortable relying just on the detainer to rule out sort of those factors, because it feels different than another offense, you know, the parole violation, maybe if that feels distinguishable. I think if this court wishes to consider all three types of prejudice, the state's argument is that this still does not demonstrate that the appellant was prejudiced. So if we're also considering the oppressive pretrial incarceration, the heightened rather than ordinary levels of anxiety, those are the two that the courts don't consider as a matter of law if they are detained on other charges as well. But the state's argument is that even if this court wishes to consider all three types of prejudice, that there is not prejudice here to the appellant.
And could you follow up on, you know, obviously, you know, on the impaired defense, I mean, you know, this witness is dead. He was presumably at the crime scene. But so why doesn't that matter? It's because we don't know. Maybe, I mean, I guess he was on both people's witness lists for whatever that's worth.
Right.
So what are we to make of that? It's just, does Mr. Saratori have the burden of saying, well, you know, had he been alive, you know, he spoke to my investigator and he would have said, you know, whatever he would have said that would have been exculpatory for his client. I mean, is that what we have to look for on these? And this impaired defense factor?
There's a few things I would say to that. I think the first is that it almost doesn't matter because the record is clear that testimony, had the trial proceeded on March 16th as appellant wanted it to, the district court's orders are pretty clear that the expectation was the first entire week would be devoted to jury selection, that the earliest possible date that testimony would start would have been that Monday, the March 23rd. And so I think that right off the bat there, we don't have prejudice because even if the trial had proceeded on the date that appellant wished for it to proceed, that witness wouldn't have been available. So I think honestly that that settles the question. As to the other piece, I think that the district court in its orders, there's two different speedy trial orders that the district court issued.
Well, maybe everyone would have, you know, I mean, maybe this would have the first time in Hennepin County that you actually would have seated a jury in less than the allotted time. It could have gone faster. And, you know, if it was gone faster, he could have been called sooner.
I suppose. I think that since the district court is the one who was managing the trial, was aware of sort of the number of witnesses. I could also look, I guess, at the transcripts to see how long jury selection did take. But since it was a first degree murder case and they, you know, go through those jurors one by one, I think that it's fair to rely on the district court's sort of findings in that regard as to whether or not the trial would have started by then. But I think the other piece is the district court in her orders, I think it was in her speedy trial orders, she noted that when reviewing the grand jury transcripts for the motion to dismiss, that this particular witness, the information that I think was given to police was that appellant was not the shooter. The other information we have in the record is that this particular witness wasn't, it doesn't sound like he was cooperative with either appellant or the state. And so I think in terms of what we have is we don't have any information that that witness would have bolstered the self-defense claim. And I think that, you know, it's clear on the record that this witness was present. It's not clear that this witness would have helped appellant's case in any way. So the state's answer really is the first point is that he wouldn't have been available either way if the trial had gone in March. Secondarily, we don't have any information that it would have been helpful. And then I think that another piece is this court has, or the Minnesota Supreme Court has rejected an argument of prejudice when it wasn't related to the delay. And I think that here, this witness's unavailability is just unrelated to the delay. And that when we look at the timing, that witness wouldn't have been available either way.
Are there other questions from my colleagues? Do you have anything more, Ms. Folks, or seeing no questions, if you want to wrap up or just continue?
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I am happy to rest on my brief, and the state would just respectfully request that this court affirm.
Thank you very much. And any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. Speaking back to the prejudice portion of my argument and what the justices have touched on with Ms. Vokes, back to Mr. Culberson. The facts are this. The trial was continued on the 16th. He was murdered 6 days later. We don't know if he would have not been in that situation, if he was getting ready to testify. We're all making speculations about why he wouldn't appear or if he would have been able to testify. The simple fact is the matter was continued on the 16th and he was killed on the 22nd, which means that he was not available to testify. Okay, it doesn't really matter what date it was. It's after the trial. So I think we're all speculating on what would have happened if, and what if the jury was selected earlier. Again, he wasn't available. Secondly, he wasn't the only witness. If you look at page 5 of the June 8th, 2020 transcript, Mr. Leary said, as the defense's attorney, we have also had difficulty with our own witnesses who have been contacting us, voicing us some concern about testifying, that they have been contacted by outside third parties, that threats have been made, all of those things. They even talked about the fact that their schedules were their schedules, that their defense attorneys were schedules were getting destroyed by or getting hampered by the constant delays. So yes, that did prejudice Mr. Wren. Next, it was oppressive. It was very oppressive. Mr. Wren was being held in COVID conditions. We all know that people were being held locked down for 23 hours a day during COVID. This is a guy who's standing trial on a first degree murder case where he's looking at life in prison. The anxiety, how much more anxiety can you have? You can't talk to the outside world. You can't communicate with people because of COVID. You weren't even allowed to use phones at some point because of COVID. So to argue that this wasn't oppressive, to me, is absurd. Now, looking at the reason for the continuance, if you look at the first reason why the state requested the continuance, it wasn't COVID, it was childcare. The prosecutor said, because the schools have been shut down, we don't have childcare.
Childcare because of the pandemic. I mean,
okay, but
it's not just, you know, my nanny quit. It's, I mean, I think, well.
There's a lot of other people who had issues and had to find childcare and did it because frontline workers and the such. The simple fact is we're talking about a man's constitutional right to a speedy trial that has been violated because of childcare based upon the so-called pandemic. I said, and to add that, to say that the state and the courts were worried about how we were going to go forward, there wasn't even any mention of masks on March 16th when the first orders came out. There was no mention of masks. We weren't even talking about masks until April. So those are
right.
All.
I'm not following your argument there. What does the masks have to do with the protocols for conducting the trial?
Your Honor, the state made a point to the answer to one of the questions, I believe it was Judge Conley's, that the state, as well as the court, were concerned of how to go forward on March 16th with all the new protocols or how things were going to go forward, including masks and distancings and plexiglass. That wasn't even thought of on March 16th. Masks weren't even a thing. Social distancing wasn't even a thing. Those were the first orders that came out as it relates to shutdowns and emergencies and the such. Nobody knew what was going on. But the simple fact is Judge English's order to continue the trial was in direct violation of the Supreme Court's order that says ongoing trials and trials of high priority must go forward. And that was ignored. I know the court is a de novo review of a speedy trial challenge, but that is almost an abuse of discretion on Judge English's part because she went forward ignoring not only the Constitution and the time that Mr. Wren had been sitting, but the fact that the Supreme Court, her superior, said go forward with trials that are ongoing and of high importance, as Mr. Wren's was.
And for that, we would have to decide that the trial had commenced, apropos of the earlier conversation, right? As when does the trial start?
Correct. Which I would argue that the trial started when the jury was impaneled, meaning that they were brought in to answer questions and sworn, because as you are sworn prior to giving questions on a questionnaire that can be used by the attorneys for voir dire. With that, I see my time is ending. Thank you. I ask the court to vacate the conviction of Mr. Wren and immediately release him from custody. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for your arguments today. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statutory time period. Have a good day, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.